Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about exploring other possibilities. What is the universe made of, and what belief systems are encompassing different worldviews? And that's why I'm talking tonight to a renowned skeptic, founder of the Skeptic Society, editor-in-chief of the magazine The Skeptic, Michael Sharma. And Michael, thanks for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Because most of the people I interview are on the other side of the equation. And
well, there is no other side. What other side? There's just science and the natural world and all the things we have yet to explain with science and the natural world. Anyway, that's my
exactly.
take on
that. I'm talking about the things we... No, but I'm talking about the things we have yet to explain that some people... come up with explanations for. I would say Michael's part of this new book out by Monkfish, which is Arguing Science, a dialogue on the future of science and spirit. Rupert Sheldrake in dialogue pretty much back and forth with Michael here, Michael Sharma. And you think, I would imagine, I don't know, that everything Rupert Sheldrake says is total nonsense. Would you say that?
Well, no, I would not use those words, but I disagree with Rupert and his worldview and his acceptance of what is loosely called the paranormal and the supernatural that I think doesn't exist at all. I think, as I hinted at before, there's just the normal and the natural and things we have yet to explain with normal and natural means. There's the word itself, paranormal or supernatural, doesn't explain anything. It's just a word. It's just like, so we have all these things we can explain with physics and biology and so on. And then we have mysteries. We can't yet explain consciousness, for example, and a few others. And so what do we use to explain them? Well, it's paranormal. That doesn't explain it. It's just a word. So the analogy I use is like astronomers have had a hard time explaining the rotation of galaxies and the expansion of galaxies with the matter that they could see. And so they invoked dark energy and dark matter to explain it. But they don't really mean it as an explanation. They just say, look, there's something else going on here. There's more stuff out there that is clearly there. We can tell by inference of its actions on stars and galaxies that there's something else there. What is it? Well, we'll call it dark energy. We'll call it dark matter. But those are just linguistic placeholders until we figure out what it actually is. And that's how science normally works. Yeah.
I agree. Dark matter, dark energy, junk DNA, those are just nonsense terms to explain to in a way it gives you that superiority that science will explain, even though that explains nothing. Dark energy, dark matter, they just say it's there. So, I mean, throughout this conversation, I might have a tendency to try to convince you, but I don't want to, of my metaphysical worldview, because that I think only exists because there aren't explanations for things, for some of the strange things. I agree with you. It all ultimately has to be science, even what might be called strange, spooky action at a distance or whatever you want to call. It's a science, whatever it is. But don't you think that the opening of quantum physics did something to objective reality that started to question the Newtonian ways of looking at things? Talk about your approach to quantum physics and the subjective point of view that Einstein, Schrodinger, Heisenberg put out there. Not that it's mystical, but it's subjective. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question that quantum physics is certainly... overturn the apple cart, so to speak, of a straight clockwork universe, at least at that level. You know, all the interesting effects that quantum physicists talk about, it's good to remember that these happen at the subatomic scale. It's not always clear that they scale up to macro level. The moon doesn't exist unless we look at it. Well, no, the moon is really there whether we look at it or not. That's a different phenomenon
than the
double slit experiment.
But saying just the double, yeah, talk about that double slit experiment, because that does seem to be on a macro scale, right?
Well, we're talking about photons of light going through one slit or another. I would call that at the micro level, not macro level. That's a quantum effect, I think, more than a macro effect like that. You know, the level of you and I, or the moon, or planets, or something like that. You know, I think, you know, for most of the macro world, Newtonian mechanics works pretty well. Although, I understand that spacecraft are adjusted using general relativity and not straight Newtonian mechanics, but that's not quantum mechanics. So I think we're much of the conversation ends up talking at different levels. Like my friend Deepak Chopra and I are always debating these subjects. And, you know, his worldview is more of a Buddhist one, where consciousness is primary. And, you know, so he very much leans on quantum physics to support a lot of his beliefs about the mind and how it affects the body and so on. And much of it, you know, he makes a big emphasis about how atoms are mostly empty space. You know, yes, that's true at that level. You know, atoms, you know, consist of these, you know, protons and neutrons in the nucleus of the atom. And then the, you know, electrons are scattered about. It's mostly empty space in between. Yes, that's all true. But the table is still solid and I can't pass my hand through it, because at the macro level, at our scale, the table is essentially solid. You can't pass through it, even though the atoms that make it up are mostly empty space. So I think much of the confusion that happens in the conversations between us it has to do with what level we're talking at. You know, what are we talking about?
Right. No, I get that, and of course, science is valid. And, I mean, it builds computers, airplanes, cars. I mean, it's done pretty much a lot of magical things. I mean, that would be considered magic, you know, 100, 200,000 years ago. But
absolutely. Well, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, much.
Yeah, if I could tell someone, I pick. Right. If you, I mean, I'm just saying, if you could come on, you have this plastic device and you could talk to anyone in the world instantly, they would think. So, But there are things that science cannot explain. Like you said, I just interviewed Deepak about his new book called You Are the Universe. And yeah, he talks about the hard question. I mean, I'm sure you've had this conversation with Deepak. How do you explain the hard questions of science, right? How did the universe begin? How did life begin? How did this thing we call awareness begin? I mean, are we getting closer, as a skeptic, to any of those answers?
Well, some of them, yes, I think. You know, physicists and cosmologists are, you know, getting a better understanding of how universes might pop into existence out of nothing, so-called nothing. You know, with quantum physics, on the other side, we also know that there isn't really nothing. You know, what appears to be nothing, you know, is this field teeming with, you know, virtual particles and energy out of which, you know, photons of light come out of nothing in the atom, you know, something from nothing, you know, and we're pretty comfortable with, you know, light being formed from, you know, atoms. Why are we not comfortable with universes popping into existence out of nothing, you know? And you know, so I think that one we have a pretty good understanding of. The one that Deepak...
But that's not an understanding. You're just... I mean, yes, it happens, but there's no understanding about that. That you're saying it's a sort of miracle, the way, you know, something popping out of nothing sounds like a miracle to me, you know? I mean,
well, yeah, when you put it that way, but that's why I said about light. You know, so like I just wrote a column in Scientific American on something from nothing. In which I quote from Lawrence Krauss, the great physicist, and I'll just read you his little quote here. That let's see, you know, something from nothing is precisely what many physicists he observes that this is precisely what happens with the light you're using to read this page. Electrons and hot atoms emit photons that didn't exist before they were emitted, which are emitted spontaneously and without specific cause. Why is it that we have grown at least somewhat comfortable with the idea that photons can be created from nothing without cause, but not whole universes? You know, and Lawrence is a, you know, he's a mainstream physicists. I'm not a physicist, so that's why I'm quoting him. You know, that we have these effects that, that really do happen. Why not scale up to the universe, since people like Rupert like to scale up, or Deepak likes to scale up,
I mean, just between, you know, you and me, it doesn't, that's not science. That's just stating what is. What would be the science? If, I mean, of course, a lot of science is guesswork and they don't know, but what would you think the science is of something from nothing? And could that imply something else? I'm not saying it does, but if you're saying something comes from nothing, or you have to explain it if we're talking about science. You can't just say it is, because now you sound pretty mystical. That's a mystical statement.
Well, I guess that gets at the question of what is an explanation in science. I mean, to what extent do you bore into the black box to see what's going on in there? And so, I mean, this is a point that Deepak makes about thought. You know, when I say, well, the neurons fire and you have this thought, yeah, but that doesn't really explain it. You know, how does the subjective qualitative qualia experience of thinking derive from molecules passing across a gap between two neurons, the synapse?
Yeah.
Well, we don't know. I have no idea. No one knows. And we still don't know. And, you know, there's just, I think, you know, there, it's possible that we'll never be able to explain it. You know, the Mysterians, you know, are you familiar with the Mysterians? You know, they believe that there's certain mysteries that can never be explained. For whatever reason, they're just inexplicable. Perhaps our brains are just not big enough to come up with an explanation. I don't know.
Now you sound really fundamental Christian, you know, like God just does that. You know, it just happens, you know, a verse and
well,
verse, you know, it just,
saying.
I can't explain it. Don't try to explain it. Yes.
Gentlemen, I had a hard time hearing you there. I think we're kind of going in and out, but
I gather from what you're saying is that
yes. I think we're boring down into the real philosophy of science of what we mean by an explanation. And I think if you question, if you push it far enough, you're going to hit an epistemological wall where we can't get past it. You know, we have to use words to communicate.
Well,
and the words themselves have baggage, and it's not always clear that we're talking about the same thing. And, you know, and what do you do with the things that we can't yet explain? You know, we have to keep an open mind about
it. Not all of that. There's a lot. But there's a lot of science that is very explainable. Newton's laws of motion, thermodynamics, the rate that objects fall, you know, what Galileo created. These are, you know, at least adequate explanations of some things, right?
Yes. Yep. So I think, you know, my intuition tells me, given that past history of science, that these hard problems we're talking about now.
You scare me when you use that word intuition. Right.
Intuition. It's okay. It's okay to use words like that occasionally because we don't know yet. Okay. But if I had to project myself into the future 500 years, say, my guess is we'll have explanations for these things. Just like, you know, 500 years ago, there was a lot we could not explain about the climate, the weather, the universe, cosmos, whatever, that we now do understand. I think we will get there. I'm not a Mysterian. I don't think there's things that we'll never explain. Mm-hmm. I think we will. I just think we're not there yet. I think the problems are really hard, and that's why we don't have explanations yet. The big ones that you mentioned earlier, consciousness, what was there before the Big Bang, you know, those kinds of big questions. Mm-hmm. I think we'll get a purchase on it and be able to explain it, but we can't do it yet.
But could it be that we need like a different way of looking at things when Rupert Sheldrake says there's a morphogenetic field? I don't think he means to be mystical. He's just trying to explain a dynamic that seems to be evident to him, you know? So he gives it a term, morphogenetic field, which has to do with the field of a species or an object that may exist on some these other terms might fill in the gaps?
Yes, maybe. I would agree that I think the way Rupert uses the word morphogenic fields, he means it as a part of the natural world, a physical phenomenon, a kind of energy, perhaps, or like something like a quantum field. So I would not say what he is describing is mystical or even paranormal.
Right.
I mean, so this is a good example. If it turned out that Rupert is right about these morphogenic fields, then that would not be paranormal. That would not be ESP or psychic power or supernatural. It would just be part of physics and neuroscience. It would be incorporated into the fields of science that study those particular phenomena.
Right. And I think this is my opinion. This is where science has to move to incorporating new ideas. Of course, you know the Thomas Kuhn book, Revolution Science and Scientific Theories, that show that there's a limitation of thought in each generation of scientists. And I think this is what we're coming up against if you want to hold on to the skeptical position. I mean, it's okay. You don't have to believe in weird things, but we can start to expand what we think is possible, right?
Yes, that's certainly true. But there's a reason science is conservative, because, you know, there isn't just Rupert Sheldrake as the alternative to mainstream science. There's 100 Rupert Sheldrakes with alternative theories, or more, thousands, who knows? Yeah, lots. So, you know, most scientists, working scientists, they don't have time to deal with any of this. You know, they're busy just trying to fulfill their grant obligations and get another grant. And, you know, they mostly work in the paradigm, the accepted paradigm, to use Kuhn's terminology. And so it really does sometimes take an outsider to break out of the box. Okay, fine. And we live in a free society, and Rupert is free to publish his books and run his experiments and try to get the attention of the public and other scientists to his theories. That's how it works, you know, to the extent he's not accepted, it's, you know, the onus is on him to just try to get attention and try to get evidence and try to convince people. That's what everyone has to do. You know, even within the paradigm, there's a lot of scientists who are trying to, you know, push the frontiers or come up with a new theory. You know, the scientists would like to win Nobel Prizes. Or just think about Kip Thorne's research with gravity waves. You know, he's been doing that since the 80s, you know, without any success at all until last year. You know, sometimes it just takes a long time, and people were skeptical until he, made the discovery.
Right. Right. No, of course. And I think that's what's so exciting about science, is that we hardly know anything, and human creativity and insight can, you know, do so much to make a difference. It already has. I mean, we're not living in huts anymore.
Yeah, I noticed that. That's a good thing.
So, but it does, I think there, and this is just my personal opinion, there's that crossover. I mean, Terence McKenna said, you know, not just him, but other people called scientism like the religion of science. And they say, you give us one miracle like the Big Bang or something from nothing, and we'll explain the rest, you know?
Right.
And it's very much like a religion that way. It's like, and I think that's the problem with science. A lot of things they know, and a lot of things they say, just trust us. We're going to figure this out one day. And like in 500 years or whatever, we're going to figure out how, neurons, biochemicals in the brain produce awareness. But maybe, we won't be able to figure it out with the same we've been searching for, you know. We need to take in other possibilities, and that might have to do with this probably dirty word called consciousness, you know.
I don't think it's a dirty word anymore. I mean, I think consciousness has become a legitimate area of study for neuroscientists. I mean, if you take someone like Christoph Koch, K-O-C-H for your listeners, you know, he's about as mainstream as it gets. He was at Caltech for decades. Now he's at the Allen Brain Institute in Seattle. And, you know, and he's interested in the subject. He and Francis Crick worked on the problem for a number of years. And they're as mainstream as it gets. So I think it's moved into the realm of legitimate study. And, you know, his approach is a testable one. Let's build from the bottom up, you know, how neurons firing in these networks produce certain phenomena. He's just working on visual consciousness, you know, visual awareness of your environment and how does that happen. Okay, so I respect that because it's testable. There's a way to get at it under the currently accepted paradigms of how science works.
Do you think anything, like if you can just play a little bit and just imagine, would there be anything that, and I know you're an atheist or at least an agnostic, but you do claim to be an atheist. Do you think there's anything that would come along that would open you up or make you consider that there's more than just science or the physical world that exists, like spirit, near-death experience? I mean, is there anything that you might experience that could shift something?
Well, I mean, there are subjective psychological states that we all experience. Love, for example. You know, I can explain a lot using neuroscience and hormones, oxytocin and dopamine and so on. But that doesn't really explain the subjective feeling I get of, you know, having love for my sweetheart or my child. I mean, they're really kind of two different things in terms of the levels at which we're talking. And so it could be that there's subjective emotional states that you can explain by neuroscience, for example, but it doesn't explain the experience one has. And it could be that's outside the realm of science in terms of, you know, subjective states of mind. You know, that might be something different. Just the level at which you're talking about.
Right. I mean, I guess the subjective experience is outside the realm of science, but science can't explain the subjective experience is what I guess the bottom line of that is, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, we know that, for example, if you infuse somebody's brain with oxytocin through nose spray, this is done normally to induce labor in pregnant women. But you can do it in subjects in the lab, males who are obviously not pregnant, and it changes their behavior. They donate more money to charity. They rate their experimental partners more kindly. They're nicer. You know, there's measurable effects of just inducing them with oxytocin. Now, that says a lot about what those emotions, those subjective states that they say that they experience, they describe in, you know, these kind of romantic words and passages. And yet we know that you can do that just mechanically by just giving them a hit of nose spray, oxytocin through nose spray. Wow. You know, so that's whether it's a causal link, it's certainly a correlation, an association between oxytocin and those feelings that people have.
Right. No, I think chemicals definitely affect. It's the result of biochemicals or a lot of subjective experiences. But have you ever had an experience that just seemed inexplicable to you?
Oh, I mean, I have. I absolutely have. And I've written about this in a number of my books and writings. For example, you know, I had an alien abduction experience when I was sleep deprived for 83 straight hours in the Race Across America bike race. I was, you know, physically exhausted, sleep deprived, and I thought I was abducted by aliens. Or more, that was decades ago. More recently,
why do you think it might not be true that you were abducted? How, maybe it was true that you were abducted by aliens. Is that possible?
No, because it was in the middle of a bike race that, you know, other people were in, and it was filmed by ABC Wide World of Sports. And in fact, you can, if you go online, you type in Michael Shermer abducted by aliens, you'll see me being interviewed by Eric Heiden in the back of the ABC truck, asking me how I'm doing. And I'm crossing the Mississippi River, and I'm like, and I'm going on about, well, last night it was fantastic. I had these, this alien abduction experience, and here's what happened. And I've written about this. No, no, it's definitely induced by sleep deprivation and physical exhaustion. And we know that you can, that, that people that like, people that climb Everest, people that are solo sailors, solo flyers, they have a sense presence effect. They feel like there's somebody else in the room, in the cockpit, in the boat, on the dog sled, the Iditarod dog sled. These are, you know, these are people that are usually alone, tired, exhausted, sleep deprived, oxygen deprived, and they sense a presence, like there's somebody else. And it's, right, it's totally physically induced. We know that the brain is capable of that. If you read Oliver Sacks's books, they're all, neurology case studies where people have these fantastic, amazing experiences, but they're induced by, you know, brain damage or chemical imbalance or whatever.
So you don't, but you don't think there's anything that survives the death of the body. There's no presence or being, right? That's being an atheist. You believe it's all biochemical, right?
Yeah, that that's right. To ask where do you go after, what happens after you die? You might as well ask, where were you before you were born? Mm-hmm. You know, nowhere.
And the people that
The pattern's gone.
What? But the people that do believe that are, and I guess in your terms, creating a wishful fantasy in order to deal with the inevitable, right? Is that what you would
say?
Well,
it's say it's a fantasy is a little too glib. Doesn't really explain it. I mean, people. Okay, first of all, you cannot conceive of yourself dead. It's impossible. You know, because to conceive of anything, you have to be conscious. You have to be aware, alive. So if I ask you, imagine yourself dead. You know, people that say, well, I can see myself in the coffin and the funeral. My friends are there. My loved ones are there. No, you wouldn't see anything. You can't experience death.
But what about... Right. Yeah. No, of course. But what about people who've had... Of course, you probably wouldn't say the near... I would say near-death experience, but you would still, I suppose, say that was a phenomena of the brain, even though... what's his name? And Alexander was a neuroscientist who believed that and had a near-death experience. What do you think of that case, the Eben Alexander case?
Okay, I know Eben Alexander. I know the case very well. So first of all, his coma was induced, artificially induced by his doctor because his brain was not shut down. He claims my brain was shut down. No, it wasn't. His own doctor says that he kept coming out of the coma screaming and he was out of control. They kept putting him back into the coma using, you know, they induced it. That's what they do. And so they could, you know, put a intubation in him and keep him alive while his brain was swollen due to this disease. Right. And, you know, so all that was artificially induced. So when he says my brain was shut down, no, it wasn't. His own doctor says his brain was quite active. You know, so even that's not a good case study. But there are others who claim, you know, they have these experiences. Okay, what's going on? Well, we know you can induce that through a number of phenomena. You can induce it through oxygen deprivation. James Murray at the United States Airport accelerates these patients, these pilots, till they black out and they have these little dreamlets where they float out of their bodies and they pass through a tunnel. White light, etc. Mm-hmm. You can induce it through artificially stimulating the temporal lobes of the brain. The subjects will have these out-of-body experiences. They're awake during their brain surgery after they cut through the skull. And then they wake them up. Brain feels no pain. Stimulate it with an electrode. This is one way the brain has been mapped. And so if you touch certain spots in the temporal lobe, people will report feeling they're floating out of their bodies or having an out-of-body experience, which is a component of the near-death experience. So we know you can do this artificially, So the fact that people have these experiences doesn't prove there's an afterlife. It proves that the brain is capable of generating these apparently paranormal experiences, which are not. They're neural experiences.
But have you ever met a psychic or a really good clairvoyant that just knew stuff that you was no explanation how?
Well, I've met a lot of psychics, and I've had psychic readings. I've studied it. You know, what appears to be knowing things is what's called cold reading. They're doing cold reading. They're not really getting information paranormally. They're getting it normally and statistically. You know, they're just saying things that are true for most people, that kind of thing. So, no, I've never been impressed by psychic readings.
Those are the bad psychics. I should get you a really good psychic. It's like there's no way, at least in my experiences, that they can know some of the specific things, because in the good psychic cases, they don't even know what they're saying. It's just coming to them, and they're just putting out information.
Right. Yeah. But that means you're doing the reading
for the person, but even not even to them. But yeah.
That means you're doing the reading. See, when they say things like, I don't know what this means, but I'm getting a white car, red dress, or he's showing me this letter, this whatever. So it's up to you now to figure out what it means. So you scan through your memory banks. What does this mean? What does this mean? Oh, yeah, my father had a white car, or my mother had a red dress, whatever. So you make the connection, not the psychic. So it's you doing the reading on yourself.
No, I know what you mean about that, but not always. I know, of course, that's true in some cases. And some cases, I think, well, just my experience, there's some very talented people who just seem to know things. Okay, well, I guess there's no convincing of that. But what about life on other planets? Maybe they haven't abducted you, but do you believe that there could be alien life out there?
Yes, of course. Absolutely. I mean, we have to make a distinction between two questions. Are there intelligent extraterrestrials somewhere in the cosmos, and have they come here? So on the first question, I would be amazed if we were the only ones. I mean, given the fact that there's hundreds of billions of galaxies, each of which contain hundreds of billions of stars. And now, from recent research, it looks like pretty much all the stars have planets. It would be stunning if there were none with life. So almost for sure, I would suspect that most planets have at least bacterial grade life, something like crude, simple cells, something like prokaryotic cells that evolved on Earth 3.5 billion years ago. That happens all the time. To get from bacterial grade life, however, to big brain, communicating, technologically sophisticated civilizations that communicate, build spaceships, or send signals out into space that we can detect is probably very, very rare. Now, given the numbers, hundreds of billions of galaxies, each of which have hundreds of billions of stars, each of which have dozens of planets, it's very likely that we're not alone, but it's probably very rare to get a species as complicated, intelligent, and culturally sophisticated as ours. So it's probably rare enough, and we're far enough apart that this explains why we haven't made contact yet. But, you know, I'm optimistic.
So you don't believe any of this?
I support the SETI program. Yeah. I've actually made donations to the SETI Institute. I think it's great that they're listening. I think we should continue listening and searching. I think we should send robots to Mars and dig and see if we can find life on Mars or fossil life on Mars, that there was once life on Mars. It wouldn't surprise me at all if we found life on Titan and other moons around Jupiter and Saturn. You know, I think that's a good program. I think it's likely we'll find success in that way and that we're not alone in the universe. But I don't think they've come here.
So you don't think any of the things that people have reported, the sightings, and even if you look on the internet, the government cover-ups, the crash in Roswell, None of those things are.
No. First of all, the alien abduction experience is very, very human centric. You know, the aliens are bipedal primates that speak in some kind of broken English. I mean, this is not the way it's going to be. I mean, we're the only.
And what about just you, the site? What about just the sightings that have been worldwide? Anything about that?
Well, so first of all, the serious ufologists and I agree that 95% of all the sightings have natural explanations. So even the believers agree that most of them are not aliens.
But what about the 1%? What about that 1% that might be something else?
Well, what about it? I mean, it's okay. There's always a residue of anomalies in any field that can't be explained. We just don't know. You can't explain everything. It's okay to just say, I don't know. Just remember that the U in UFO means unidentified. It doesn't mean extraterrestrial, doesn't mean conspiracy, doesn't mean government cover-up. It just means, I don't know. You know, I saw a weird thing in the sky. What is it? I don't know. That doesn't mean it's extraterrestrial.
But I'm not saying it's, but the human, I guess, curiosity and intelligence likes to, just like science does, you know, call it dark matter. We all like to explain things we don't understand. Yeah, some people may call it extraterrestrial when it is just unidentified, but our impulse as humans, as creative beings, wherever that comes from, is to explain things, right? That's just a natural thing. That's why science exists, as an explanation.
Absolutely, totally, absolutely. It's what we do. You know, and
I'm just explaining it, me and I. Yeah, go ahead. Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, explaining things is what we do. This is our species. We like to understand things, and that's good. That's the driving force behind science. I'm just saying that it's okay to say we don't know everything. And I think you would agree with that.
But there are, I totally agree. We don't know any, we hardly know anything, I would even say. There's probably a lot we don't know that we do know, and we'll be really surprised in 100 years, like I think you've said, that how far we have come. But I have seen things, and they were unexplainable, but I do, just my opinion, think that we could be visited by beings that are outside the cultural framework, so they're disregarded. It's what Larry Dawsey calls meteorite thinking. You know, meteors, rocks don't fall from the sky, as they, you know that story in the 1890s.
Yes, of course I do. But eventually you get, they got actual meteorites. I mean, they got them, and we got an explanation. And
yeah,
we
but
don't
they
have
had
that
to
yet.
Change.
You don't have that for aliens.
No, but they have.
Show me the alien spacecraft, and I'll believe.
Okay, I'm going to take you to Area 51 and show you what the government captured in 1947.
Okay, if you can get in there, I would love to go. I'll go with you.
But there were meteorite thinking didn't allow rocks to fall from the sky based on the science of its day, you know, the science of planets were clockwork. I mean, so based on the science of our day, of course, there are no extraterrestrials because it doesn't make sense within the paradigm that we culturally exist in. But I do think science is based on a cultural framework. And that's really what I want all of us to go beyond the limitations of the conditioning to see things in a bigger picture. So if you were to go beyond your framework or mine, and what would you include in that bigger worldview, what would you give an explanation to? I'm not saying you're a scientist, but you're intelligent to make guesses.
Well, the fact that,
you know,
the fact,
what I'm asking?
Yes. So the meteorite story, you know, is a classic one. You know, they laughed at Galileo and turned out he was right. They laughed at the Wright brothers. You know, well, they laughed at the Marx brothers. You know, being laughed at doesn't make you right.
Right.
And being persecuted doesn't make you right. And the fact that some of these people that were pointed to and said they were wrong turned out to be right doesn't mean that everybody who was laughed at or pointed to as wrong turned out to be right. Most of them turned out to be wrong.
Right. Exactly. But what are we not, but I'm asking you, what are we ridiculing now within the limited worldview that you think could be vindicated in 100 years? You know, who are the Galileos of today what do you see as like pushing the edge? I mean, you know what I'm saying?
I do. But and if I knew, I would know. I would do something about it. But I don't know. I mean, like everybody else, I'm stuck in the paradigm we have, and that's just the way it goes. It's probably something to do. One of the theories of consciousness probably turns out to be right, but it could be we're all getting it wrong. You know, I just don't know. We don't know. It's too soon to tell.
Well, which theory of consciousness do you go along with? I'm just curious.
I go along with just the bottom up emergent property of neurons firing, nothing more than that. I think it's going to have to scale up from simple to complex neural networks. I think it's going to be nothing more than that.
But where does the self-reflective quality come in within that scaling up?
I don't know. I don't think we know that yet.
Well, I think we could scale down and.
Yeah.
That's their semi self-reflective. If we go to lesser developed brains, they seem to be less self-reflective, right? So
yeah, absolutely.
It could
right, exactly.
A brain size.
So that alone tells us that it's neural activity. You just need more cortex to do all this stuff.
Or the other theory is you need more cortex in order for consciousness to be, I'm just playing, grounded in the brain to have the self-awareness. You can't have the reflection of the mind, the greater mind, without the neural context or cortex, you know?
Yeah, yep.
You know what I'm saying?
That's right, yeah.
I'm just saying to you, we can say, you can lock yourself into skepticism, which is fine, you know, I don't, whatever you want to believe, but it's still belief. And I think it's fun to just play like Rupert does or Deepak or to
sure.
play
yeah,
with.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's where new ideas,
I'm not saying you should,
new ideas come from yeah. Playfulness. It's okay.
Right. I'm sure. I mean, Einstein, that was really way out there. And I think most people still don't understand what he said, but enough people have in order to change the whole idea of science itself, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, and I think that what Deepak's getting at is there is no objective reality. Ultimately, it all comes down to the observer, to the individual observer. Would you say that's...
Well, if everything came down to the individual observer, then we wouldn't know anything for sure. And I don't think that's the case. I think we can be confident that certain things are real, whether we observe it or not.
Well, like matter, like this, like, you know, the table or whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right.
But what is, I guess you can explain, what's the goal or do skeptics just exist, or the skeptical society exist in reaction to the weird things people believe, or is it its own kind of foundation of belief?
There is a skeptical movement that started initially in response to claims of the paranormal and supernatural, but in fact, really, it turns out all of science is skepticism. I mean, they're all skeptics in the sense of thinking critically about claims, demanding evidence for the claim before we accept it as true. You know, that turns out that's just a normal part of science. That's how science works. And, you know, it's conservative, but for a reason, because there's, you know, for every Rupert Sheldrake, you know, there's 100 other alternative. Which ones are the real ones? We don't have time to test them all. So you gotta be conservative about it. It's just the way it goes.
But then science comes up with this idea of dark matter, which is a total joke, and anyone would know it's a fudge factor, and we're supposed to believe it, and most scientists don't even question it now because it's been accepted by me, and there's no basis in any reality for dark matter, dark energy.
That's not true. There are effects. I mean, galaxies rotate at a speed that is not explainable by the matter that's in them that we can measure and see. So there's something else holding these galaxies together to rotate at those speeds. And in the second phenomenon is the expansion, the accelerating expansion of the universe. It can't happen by the matter that we see. There's something else. Call it whatever you want, the X factor. It doesn't matter. Those are just words. We don't understand it yet, but there's something definitely else going on that calls for an explanation.
Well, my explanation, my thing made it up. I mean, what I was thinking about that is that possibly, well, they're saying there's a dark black hole in the center of every galaxy that's pulling matter in, and the weight of those black holes may be much heavier than we can scientifically measure at this point, which would make up all that missing energy. What do you think of that theory?
Okay, well, write it up and submit it to a physics journal. You know, hey, I'm just on a Scientific American homepage here because I write for them, and here's an article called "Is It Time to Give Up on Dark Matter?"
Exactly. So
there you go. There you go. Lydia Chain, Lee Billings, and Michael Lemonick, January 17th, published today. There is still good reason to think
there you go.
Well, undiscovered fundamental particles act as gravitational glue for galaxies. Okay, so there you go. Click on that, and you can see if it's time to give up on dark matter.
But okay, all right. But is there? There does seem to be just a biological intelligence that exists. I mean, the way the bodies are formed. I mean, maybe it's just a natural evolutionary process, but if we talk about evolution, Darwin in a way didn't explain anything. He didn't explain how he explained adaptation, but he didn't explain speciation, how one species becomes another species. He said it was a genetic mutation, but that seems like a made up story as well. So how do you explain evolution?
Well, Darwin did not have the mechanism. He didn't know about genes and how that works. He just observed the phenomenon of branching speciation across geographical space and came up with his theory of natural selection simultaneously with Alfred Russel Wallace. And it's one of the most well-supported theories in all of the history of science. So it would be startling if it's not true. And now that we have the mechanism, you know, population genetics and genetics itself and so on, it carries a lot of weight in science. It would be stunning if it was not true.
No, I'm not saying evolution isn't a fact. It's the mechanism, like Deepak and people like Bruce Lipton. Have you debated him? He talks about epigenetics. So evolution is an intentional almost a modification, not a chance mutation. That's the argument, I think.
I understand. It's possible that there's some epigenetic effects within a lifetime of an organism instead of across individuals only. Although obviously that's not always the effect, since the Jewish rite of circumcision has been in operation for thousands of years, and yet little boys are still born with foreskins. So clearly not all changes in the physical environment affect the genome.
No, I mean, I don't think they Lamar. That's not a way to prove epigenetics. I think that's a silly argument. I think it's more like, and the intention, you know, to grow longer legs, to run of in a way effect on the genes, not cutting off rats' tails as they disprove Lamarck's theories or circumcision I think it's more a part of some environmental factors that seem to modify the gene somehow. I don't explain it, but it sort of makes sense to me that there's some intention effect on the genetic makeup.
Well, I think there's a difference between the environment affecting genes and that word intention. It implies that there's an intender who's running the show, and there's no evidence for that in biology. That's my very sentient, conscious dog communicating. He wants me to get off the interview and feed him. So maybe it's time.
Okay, but you see, so is there ever, basically the book Arguing Science is really one of the oldest arguments in the world, because there's always been those two schools of thought. There's the rationalist and there's the mystic. Will they ever meet, I guess, is my big question to you.
I think the mystic will have to become scientific for there to meet, and I think that's what's already been happening. I think that's the history of science. The mystics have become naturalists.
And you don't think the scientists will ever have a mystical experience that they can say, you know what, there's more to the world than I rationally
Yes. Well, they can and they do, and that's okay. But that doesn't necessarily change the science. At some level, you have to be able to test it.
Right, but there, you know, that left and right brain split. There's the rationalist, which goes, science is only using half the brain. There's the intuitive side. Like you even use that word, that sometimes we just know. Because we feel something, we get a hit of something, we get a, you know, immaterial sense of it. That, you know, that might be an experience waiting for you to happen to you somehow. I don't know.
Maybe.
But so, yeah, well, look forward to it. But anyway, so what's coming up for you with as a skeptic and the skeptic? Skeptic magazine. What can you talk about that?
Yep. So if your listeners want to go to skeptic.com, that's our webpage where you can read about our various issues. Everyone has a particular theme to it, so we just investigate, you know, different claims. Mm-hmm. So we're working on a lot of different issues. You know, cancer quackery is a big one. Alternative medicine is a big one. You know, because there's a lot of quackery out there.
There may be an answer in some of those you call them quackery, but some of them may have some valid ideas. Don't you think that's possible?
You know what we call alternative medicine with evidence? What? Medicine.
Okay. Well, it starts.
So you gotta have evidence. There's, you know, 100 different cancer cures. Okay. Yeah. Which is the right one? You got to test them. That's the only way to find out. Got to test it. It's the only way to know.
But I guess my final question is because it seems if you're a skeptic, is there any magic in the world for you?
Is there any magic? Yeah. Love. Absolutely.
Okay. Because you can't explain that, right?
That's right. There's some things that are not explainable.
Okay. Well, at least we got you on love. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well,
thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks for having me. And, glad to be here. You're welcome. And we'll do it again soon.
Yeah, I just want to say the book we've been sort of referring to often is Arguing Science, Michael Shermer, Rupert Sheldrake, Monkfish, and it's worth reading just to kind of get a reflection of the two sides of civilization that have been at it for a long time. Okay, and your website, Michael, you said?
Skeptic.com. Okay. Skeptic.com or MichaelShermer.com.
Thanks so much for being a guest.
You're welcome, Alan. You're welcome.
Okay, talk to you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Okay. I'm Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. I've been talking to Michael Shermer. He is a skeptic, which is fine. I usually like talking to people because I just find there's no room to go. There's no adventure. There's no possibilities with people who have beliefs that don't include the unknown. And I think the unknown is not always provable. I think it's something we have to feel. And I think the inner awareness is more what's coming into the collective than just the hardcore science, because science has gotten us into trouble pretty much for the most part. You know, we need to look to other answers, and not throw out the science, but include the mystical, include the unknown, include the right brain. So my name is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to know more about what I'm doing, go to newrealities.com. Go to my YouTube, youtube.com/newrealities, or look it for my series right here on BBS Radio in the archives. And every week I deal with some aspect of the mystical awakening. So thanks for listening. Good night.